Welcome to the book show, heard coast to coast. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books, and we've got a terrific show for you folks. This evening, we're going to be talking to David Baldacci, author of The Christmas Train. And actually, he just called the studio.
We just got off the phone with him.
He's so anxious to get on the book show. He's actually here in Richmond, Virginia.
I wish we would have known sooner. We could have done a live there.
We could have done a live remote. He's at a bookstore here on the west end of
Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble on the west end of Richmond, Virginia. And I talked to David's, I guess, publicity agent.
Correct.
Yeah, and she told me that something like 800 people were at
his homecoming. Whole family here. I guess he lives here in Richmond, is he?
Yeah, Baldacci lives in Virginia. I'm not sure.
Or from here, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So we broadcast live, of course, from Richmond, Virginia, and David Baldacci is a native Virginian. So we're going to be interviewing him about his book, The Christmas Train, and this is kind of
different,
outside the typical genre that David Baldacci writes in. He is a 7-time New York Times bestselling author. Books such as Absolute Power, Total Control, The Winner, The Simple Truth, Saving Faith, Last Man Standing, and Wish You Well. These are some of his best-selling books. And The Christmas Train is a departure from that. And he's getting some really, really good reviews. In fact, one review, I think I read it on Amazon.com. It was from Publishers Weekly. And I wanted to ask David about this because Publishers Weekly said, "This is a more warm-hearted and enjoyable novel than Grisham's comparable holiday offering last year, Skipping Christmas." I don't know if David regards Mr. Grisham as a rival or not, but this is
Both done very well financially.
Yeah, they both have done really well. Why don't I tell everybody, Christmas Train, I'm just going to read from the jacket of the book here. Disillusioned journalist Tom Langdon must get from Washington to L.A. in time for Christmas, forced to take the train across the country because of a slight, quote, misunderstanding.
It's a comedy. Make sure you understand this up front, okay?
There's a misunderstanding at airport security, and it begins a journey of self-discovery and rude awakenings, mysterious goings-on, and thrilling adventures, screwball escapades, and holiday magic. He has no idea that the locomotives pulling him across America will actually take him into the rugged terrain of his own heart as he rediscovers people's essential goodness and someone very special he believed he had lost. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Really interesting. So we're going to get to Mr. Baldacci at about 6:15 or so. We're also going to be talking, of course, to MJ Rose. She does our What's News in Publishing this week. She's an author and journalist out of New York City. She has come out with a book, Flesh Tones. It's been out for a while. Very well received. If you're interested in MJ Rose's book, Flesh Tones, go to www.mjrose.com or your local bookstore like Barnes & Noble or Borders. We're also going to announce new contests if we have them tonight on Contest Corner.
We
always do. Okay. Contest Corner, which is sponsored by Writer's Digest Magazine, America's number one magazine for writers. And later in the show, we're going to have America's best-selling books this past week. And for some reason, when I was trying to crank out the best-selling books, it's usually USA Today, but USA Today wouldn't come up on my computer. I did it over and over and over again.
I was on TV today doing a story about one of our sponsors, eNovel, and I try to bring up a site, UBID, where I do a lot of purchasing. Right. I couldn't get that site to come up either. The web is...
Yeah, I don't know.
Acting funky
maybe
tonight.
Maybe it's WorldCom's UUNet. Maybe bankruptcy really is hurting WorldCom. We'll have to see. So I did Amazon's top 10 best-selling books. Our sponsors for the show, one of our sponsors was Bookbinders Restaurant. I just have to say that I was there last night, and it was just utterly fabulous.
It just gets better every
time. Oh, it gets better every time. The wine was marvelous, and I had this seared tuna dish, which was just out of this world.
You're not the first person that's told me that.
Yeah, it was delicious. By the way, the crab cakes are really good, too. For those of you who are new listeners to the show, what is the book show about? The show is about books and the people that write them. But it's not an NPR-style book interview show, folks. This is Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. We like to interview authors who have written books on hot topics, timely issues, provocative, controversial subjects, or timely as in it's of the season.
Absolutely.
And this book is certainly
The Christmas Train.
Yeah, it is. The Christmas Train. It's of the season.
Oh, my gosh. I've been out to the mall and I usually don't go to the mall, but Christmas is here in full swing everywhere.
Well, you're not going to believe this. Right after Labor Day, It was early September, and I was in Hex department store, and believe it or not, on the second or third floor, they already had their Christmas display out then.
Oh, music player. Now, I like the music, so it's a positive for me, but my gosh, it seems early.
Yeah, now MG Rose is going to be coming on in a few minutes, and there's a story that she's going to talk about. It's about Gemstar TV Guide. It's a company, Gemstar.
Yes, Gemstar, they make the Rocket eBook.
They make the Rocket eBook. Well, they're in financial difficulties like a lot of high-tech companies, and they may sell some of their assets, including their eBook operation.
Wow.
Okay, and that's one of the stories we're going to talk about, but I don't want to steal MJ Rose's thunder. I was getting my email just last Thursday or Friday, and Gemstar, I got the Gemstar eBook newsletter. Okay. And interestingly enough, on the in my newsletter, they have a list of 20 eBooks to give or receive this holiday season. And you're not going to believe, the very first one was The Christmas Train.
Awesome.
By David Baldacci.
Now, question for you. Do they say any pricing on there, how it compares to the retail of a traditional paper book?
Well, great question. They do have the ebook price, which in my opinion is still
too
high.
Well, this is $19.95 for the paper book.
Okay, $19.95, right. The ebook version of The Christmas Train. List price $14.95. Gemstar price $11.96. So it's $12 for an ebook versus.
It seems a little steep to me.
It does. I think they need to go down around the $8 range or so. Okay, I think MJ Rose is with us.
MJ, are you there?
I'm here.
Great.
Hey, MJ, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
We're just talking about David Baldacci, who's going to be on in a few minutes, about the Christmas Train.
Oh, my friend Carol Fitzgerald just adores that book. I haven't read it yet, but she said it's wonderful.
Is that right? He happens to be in Richmond, Virginia right now doing a book signing. Probably as a crow flies, he's six miles away. He's really close. And by the way, I got the Gemstar ebook newsletter, e-newsletter, and they have the top 20 ebooks to give or receive this holiday season, and the first one is The Christmas Train.
Oh.
But you know, the Gemstar price, tell me what you think, $11.96 for an ebook.
As compared to the hardcover book in your hand of $19.95.
Oh, you know, this is such a slippery slope and a problem, because originally we all thought that ebooks should be priced between $4 and $6.
Exactly, that's what we've always
said. They should replace mass market paperbacks. That's the form of book that you don't save anyway. You don't save your mass market paperbacks. You
Correct.
Don't save ebooks. I mean, they're not something you can put on a shelf. So they should be priced the same. The problem happened because the big publishers are releasing the ebooks at the same time as the hardcover, which makes sense. But if they are releasing this the same time as the hardcover, they don't want to discourage hardcover sales by making the ebook $4 to $6 while the hardcover is $19 or $20 or $24. So that's what the weird thinking is behind these prices. As a result, I think that they're not getting a lot of sales because the price is too high. On the other hand, they're not cannibalizing their hardcover sales, which is what they're frightened of.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for, the cannibalizing. I just think the markets are...
They're so different, though.
Yeah, still, they're so different. I don't think there's much overlap yet.
Anyone's looking for a hardcover book is not the same person, in my opinion, as buying an ebook.
I agree with you, but I also understand their point that if they really did make it $6, how many more people would start reading it as an ebook to save the money?
And how much would they save on printing and shipping and returns? And so, yeah, I guess you have to balance it.
I mean, they wouldn't make as much on the ebook, because
right.
they make on a $20 book, they're making profit probably about $4 or $5, and on a $4 ebook, they're probably making $3.
Exactly.
So it's not a, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you multiply it times, you know, 100,000 books, a lot of money.
Right, it is. All right, let's get into your news items, MJ.
One of them has to do with Gemstar, so why don't we go in reverse?
Yeah, that sounds good.
So, yeah, Gemstar, now for people who don't know, originally the ebook part of Gemstar was a company called the Rocket eBook, which was this wonderful device that everybody thought was going to revolutionize reading.
I have about three or four of them in my house.
Yeah, they were cool. And then this guy named Henry Ewan, who owned Gemstar, came in and bought the Rocket ebook and completely changed it. Among the more bizarre things that he did to it was that you could no longer hook the ebook up to your computer and download an ebook. You had to hook the device up to your phone
and get it from them.
Get it from a phone. And it was like, huh? This is an ebook. Why are we dealing with the phone? That was just one of the things he did. But anyway, he's been ousted, which not a lot of people in publishing are upset by. And now the whole ebook division of GemStar is for sale.
I thought that GemStar also went with a proprietary closed ebook format.
Yeah, one of the weird things they did where you couldn't go to the internet and download any old document and read it on your ebook reader, which you were able to do with the Rocket, which was so great because you could buy self-published novels, you could buy articles, you could download free Gutenberg books, you know, anything that was free you could download, and people could use it for all kinds of things. He changed that. So you could only buy a GemStar ebook, which only came from certain publishers, and he didn't buy from self-published or cooperative publishers. He really closed it up. And there was another really weird thing he did, but I can't remember. Oh, he took out patents, thousands of patents on things like the word ebook, trying to make it all proprietary.
Yeah.
It was really, really crazy. It was like in 2000. He also didn't ever talk to the press. We really had a hard time interviewing him.
Right.
But he's been ousted. I guess what goes around comes around.
And like you said, good news for the industry.
Yeah, and they're going to try to sell it, but the fascinating thing about trying to sell it is that nobody in the industry has any way to put any value on it because ebooks haven't taken off. And what he paid for it was in the many, many millions is so impossible to really figure out in today's market that I don't imagine anybody's going to buy it for what GemStar is probably going to want to sell it for.
Probably a penny on a dollar.
Probably. Well, unfortunately, like Salon, which I didn't put the news in, but they were downgraded from NASDAQ this week, and nobody knows if they're going to survive.
Oh,
Apparently, they have to get the money by December 1st or they're going under.
Wow. Downgraded as in delisted?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they've spent over $70 million on Salon in the past
five or six years,
mostly on a $40 million television campaign, which everybody thought was like really a dumb thing to do with $40 million.
Right.
I guess everybody was right.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. The next news item is the Book Awards,
National Book Awards, which are really the Oscars of the book industry. And if we continue with that analogy, then the Fiction Book Award that won really was somebody that really very few people had heard about, and a book that did get really good reviews but really was not a huge book, and a debut at that, and written by a woman at that, which is even more unusual.
Right.
Julia Glass won for a book called 3 June. And it was just a huge shock to everybody.
Right.
Because
I got a question for you about these awards. To me, with all the books that are coming out every year, and sure, a small percentage of them are really good, and the rest are not. But still, you're looking at a lot of books that potentially could win an award. It's so subjective. How much of this is just kind of, I don't know, politics and favoritism, and how much is it, you know, really legitimate? I mean, how much faith can we put in this award?
Well, I don't think that it's politics. And I don't think it's favoritism, but I'll tell you what it is. And we can skip the middle story because I think that this is more interesting. What happens is an average judge of this show gets about 400 books to judge. And that's where the first part of the issue comes in.
Wow.
The books are sent by the publishers. They're not sent by readers. They're not found by the judges. They're not found by the committee. Each publisher pays, I think it's $100 to submit a book, and submits the books they want to submit. So they only submit a certain number of books.
Right.
Because that could get very expensive. So, I know in the nonfiction award, there were 400 books submitted. And the book that won was Robert Caro's book about Lyndon Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
But 400 books are sent in. Now, I've talked to some judges who I happen to know, not of this award, but of another one, who are my friends. and hear them say things like, oh, the so-and-so publisher didn't send their books until 3 weeks before the deadline was closed, and I already had 20 other books to read, and I never got to them.
Mm.
Now, that's not politics, it's not favoritism, but it's messy.
Yeah,
I'd say so.
And the other thing that happens is a reviewer is friendly with another reviewer, and the two of them are at lunch, and one says, I really loved X, Y, and Z, and the other says, oh, I didn't read that one yet, but doesn't that make life simpler to know that that person really liked that book?
Yeah.
As opposed to the Oscars, where the nominations are voted on by the entire Academy of tens of thousands of people. They can pick any movie as long as it was released.
I see.
So it's a very different system, and the Oscars allow for much more interesting, I believe, choices to be made.
So right. What do you think a better scenario would be, to take people who review books like yourself and us and get a pool of literally, hopefully, 1,000 different people
to put their
input in?
Yeah, well, that's more, yes. But in order to do that, you'd have to have an organization that all these people belong to.
Well, sort of like sports writers that decide who's the national champion in football and things
like
that.
Okay, well, there's another award show called the National Book Critics Circle.
Uh-huh.
And that award show happens in March. That's, but unfortunately, the thing you're suggesting doesn't happen that way either. It's the same thing where the publishers submit the books, and then the people who belong to the National Book Awards can write in books, and that can get chosen that way. But unfortunately, it's not as prestigious as an award, and doesn't get quite as much notice.
I think it's time to start a new one.
Well, I keep saying we need a People's Award.
There you go.
I want you guys to do that with Carol Fitzgerald at the Book Reporter, to do a Reader's Book Award.
Let's talk off the record on this after the show, say, you know, Monday or Tuesday, because I think this is a great idea.
Yeah, I think it would be really fun.
MJ, next week, let's talk about this article, Teachers Rap Lessons
really
in Fiction. Because we got to call up David right now.
Have a great time.
Hey, thanks so
much.
MJ. Have a good week.
You too.
That's
bye-bye.
MJ Rose, author and journalist from New York City. I'm sorry, I thought we had gone on a break. We're going to be talking to David Baldacci, and we're going to call him in just a moment, okay? So this is The Book Show, Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books. We'd love to talk to you, by the way, on WLEE Hot Talk 990. You can reach us at 788-0990 locally. Okay, we're going to be right back.
Remember when you were little? And the most fun you had was the fun you made for yourself. Like making a tent out of kitchen chairs and a blanket. Or pretending you were called on to make the last basket for the championship of the world. Imagination is a wonderful thing. And when you come to Luray Caverns with your kids, be sure and bring it with you. The kids will. There's no telling what their minds will see in the cave's formations. They'll be pretending that they're exploring an ancient galaxy, or hiding from spies, or looking for lost treasure. And if you've got any kid left in you, you will too.
Luray Caverns, be a caveman.
Hot Talk 990. We're listening.
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to enovel.com. At enovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. Enovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, Enovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.enovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.
Do you like to write? If so, Writer's Digest, the world's leading magazine for writers, is for you. Since 1920, Writer's Digest has provided expert writing instruction, inspiration, and up-to-date marketing information. Each month, readers turn to Writer's Digest to discover technical columns geared towards specific genres, including screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and more. Publishing information, including how to write solid cover letters that catch the interest of agents and editors. Tips and tricks for overcoming writer's block. career opportunities, interviews with best-selling authors, tools of the trade, including the latest information on writing software and hardware, legal advice for writers, and much more. Log on to www.writersdigest.com/thebookstore today and ask for your two free issues. You'll see why more than 200,000 writers rely on Writer's Digest every month to learn the secrets of getting their words polished, published, and paid for.
Before the shopping, before the decorating, before the greeting cards, kick off the holiday with an evening of Yuletide inspiration. Attend the 11th Annual Festival of Music, where the Richmond Symphony will perform classic Christmas carols and popular tunes on Monday, December 2nd at 7:30 p.m. Reserve your tickets now by calling Commonwealth Catholic Charities at 285-5900.
WLEE Hot Talk 990.
Welcome to the book show, heard coast to coast. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books, and we are going to bring on David Baldacci, author of The Christmas Train. And David, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you?
Welcome to the book show.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
How's the book signing going?
We probably signed about 1,000 books tonight, so it went very well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
1,000. So are you finished with it?
Just finished.
You just finished?
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations, 1,000 books.
Your arm must be sore.
Yeah, you know, I had that bionic implant done a couple of years ago. It was really great.
Now, we're based, our show broadcasts out of Richmond, Virginia, which is where you are as well. Were you born and raised a Virginian?
I was, yeah, Richmond. I went to public schools and VCU, and then went on to Charlottesville for law school at UVA, but, you know, I'm a native Virginian.
You're an attorney.
Yes, I was. I practiced law for about 10 years in Washington, but, you know, I was a closet writer since high school, and... Now I write full-time.
Full-time. And what was your very first book?
Absolute Power.
Absolute Power. How old were you when you got that published?
35.
35.
Yeah, I'd only been writing for about 18 years.
My goodness.
So was it hard to get that first one, though, published?
Well, I'd been through a lot of different careers as a writer. I was a short story writer for a long time, and I wrote screenplays for film and had an agent out in L.A., and I thought maybe I'd be a script writer. And I had this idea for a first novel. It was Absolute Power, and then, you know, it was like everything clicked, and you know, the book sold and was a best major bestseller, and the film rights and foreign rights, and then, boom, I was an overnight success, you know, of about 6,000 nights.
And most of your books, or all of your books, are kind of suspenseful, thriller-type books. Is that correct?
Yeah, all except one, well, except for the latest one, The Christmas Train, Wish You Well, was a period piece set in 1940 in Southwest Virginia. But other than that, all my other novels have been suspense novels, yes.
What prompted you to write The Christmas Train?
Well, I love trains, and two, I had taken this cross-country train trip last year, and 3.5 days on a train as a writer, if you can't get your creative juices flowing, you must be dead. And I had no intention really of writing a story about it, although I have written stories on trains, and I've written some short stories about trains and things like that over the years. But I was finishing up my last novel. I was heading out to California to give a speech to the California State Bar, and all of a sudden I'm sitting on the train, and all these interesting people and conversations and observations are going on. So I grabbed my pad, and I just traveled the train for 3.5 days and just wrote as much as I could down. Never thought I'd distill it really into a novel, but then the more I thought about it, I thought if I set this during Christmas and make it a journey that this guy has to take, what a nice story it would be. So that's really the genesis of The Christmas Train.
The characters in The Christmas Train, did you draw any from... any of the characters from your trip on the train? Or
I did. Several of them are composite. I found that people who work on Amtrak, it's almost like a traveling circus.
We've been on Amtrak before.
Yes.
They are characters, and a lot of them have second lives. You know, they're singers on the side, or they're stand-up comedians, and, you know, it's like this one big family traveling on the rails, and the crews have worked the same train. It's not like planes where, you know, a flight attendant might be on 15 different planes in one day. These people work these same trains, and it's almost like the trains have personalities of their own. And so a lot of the characters in The Christmas Train are composite of the people I met along the way.
Right.
And some of the stories, too, that are in the book are things that happened to me along the way.
You say at the beginning of the book here, this novel is dedicated to everyone who loves trains and holidays.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about your love of trains.
Trains, for me, I don't get to take them that often. I usually have to fly because I need to get somewhere in a hurry, particularly on book tours. But for me, growing up and reading all the great train mysteries, it was always very appealing. But if you think about it, we rush everywhere, and we never really stop to think about, you know, who we're traveling with or anything about the journey itself. But trains, you step on them, and all of a sudden, the pace slows down a little bit. You look across at the person sitting across from you. Instead of just never wanting to say a word to them, you open up, and they open up to you. It's almost like, gee, I've checked back into the human race again.
Right.
And I can actually talk to someone and have a little bit of period of time where I can take a breath, not pound away on my laptop, go to the lounge car, have a drink, you know, eat a real meal at a real table, and stroll around and visit with people who you're probably never going to see again, which I think is one reason people open up to you on trains. And
I noticed that on the train coming down from New York down to Richmond. I took that one time. And the dining car, you get seated with other people. It's not, you don't get your own table.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely like not by Northwest with Cary Grant. And no. You get seated with complete strangers, and it's like, okay, you sit down, and you're going to stare at your plate for an hour, or are you actually going to make conversation? And you know, when I was riding the trains, I made conversation with people, and you get lots of interesting stories in return. I don't know if the people who ride trains just have more fascinating lives or else they're lying. But I got a lot of good material on it. And trains for me represent, you know, a romantic way to travel, a slower pace. It has some magnetism to it that it's hard to explain, but it's stepping back in time, but at the same time, mm-hmm. Enjoying yourself and not worrying about where you're going, but just thinking about how you're getting there.
Are you a collector of trains?
Well, no, other than you know, having written the book about the train. But I ride them whenever I can. I've ridden a bunch of trains now in this country, and I've ridden a number of them overseas as well.
Right.
And again, I've written lots of stories on trains. It's a nice place if you want to be isolated and you want to meditate, stare out the window while you're trying to create a story. It's very therapeutic.
And let's talk a bit more about the book itself. What's this story about?
The protagonist, the main protagonist, is Tom Langdon, who's this journalist who spent his entire career covering all the bad things in the world, wars overseas and famines and things like that, and he's had it, basically, because he wanted to change the world with his writing, and it didn't happen. So he came back to the States and started writing fluff for, you know, magazines. And that was not fulfilling. Now, what starts the whole book in motion is that he has to get from Washington to L.A. in time for Christmas. Lele Gibson is his girlfriend, and they're going to go to Tahoe for Christmas. So he has to get across the country. He has a teeny tiny problem. He had this super meltdown at LaGuardia Security at the airport, and they won't let him on any plane again. So he has to take the train across the country, and he thinks, well, I'll take the train, I'll write a nice little story about it, and that'll be it, and I'll go and spend Christmas with Lelia. Well, once he gets on the train, all of a sudden these weird things happen. He has all these adventures and thrills. There's mystery on board. He meets all these zany characters. It's like an old screwball comedy on rails, and he also meets what he thought was the lost love of his life. So this train trip just to spend Christmas and maybe write a nice little story about it becomes this journey crossroads for him, because he is really taking a journey. He's got to make an important decision about his life. Where does he go from here? He's lived half his life, and he's not happy. He has no idea how to spend the rest of his 40 years he has left. And this trip, this journey, answers those questions for him. And over Christmas time, you know, which I always have always sensed this a season of redemption and renewal, he gets a second shot at being happy.
Right. So what's the moral of this story? Or are there a few morals of this story?
Well, some of them are that he sets off on a journey thinking he's going to accomplish one thing. Maybe he's going to have a life-altering decision, but he thinks it's going to be a certain way. And I think one of the messages is that when many people start journeys like this, the end result is nothing that they thought it was going to be, but it actually turns out better. So if you have all this pre-programmed sort of plan with your life and vision to what it's going to be, 9 times out of 10, those things don't always happen, and 9 times out of 10, they don't always happen for the right reasons. So going into a journey like that, you need to be open-minded and flexible and sort of adapt to what comes down the pike. And the second thing is, I think if you're not happy with your life, you should take some steps to correct that, because complacency has killed more people than probably anything else. And you only have one go around, and if a second opportunity comes along, advice would be to seize it.
It's sort of when you least expect it, boom, there you, it happens to you.
It does, and you got to be ready for it. And hopefully Tom Langdon is.
I read somewhere that You have a number of different favorite books. I think Cider House Rules and Bonfire of the Vanities. Yeah. Any new ones that have come up that you like, current books?
I've really gotten into nonfiction as of late, although I still read lots of different fiction. Sue Grafton is one of my favorite writers. I read lots of Patsy Cornwell stuff. I've been reading more nonfiction, David McCullough's biographies, Edwin Morris's, his biographies of Teddy Roosevelt. I'm just reading Truman now, finishing that up, and McCullough's work. But reading is what got me to writing, and when I opened a book as a kid and would go into a completely new world, you have to understand that all a writer has are little printed symbols on a page, which don't seem very exciting compared to being able to go to a movie or listen to music at a concert. But I always thought that if somebody could enthrall me with these little unexciting printed symbols on the page, that was real, true talent. And that's what I wanted to be able to do. So, but for my love of reading, I would not have become a writer.
So these nonfiction books that you're reading, are they going to culminate in possibly a new book?
Well, I think a lot of the reading that I do is for pleasure. I'm working on a new suspense novel now that'll be out in the latter part of next year that I'm very excited about. Even as a fiction writer, though, there are certain broad elements of nonfiction in my work. When I write about the FBI or the Secret Service or the Office of the Presidency, obviously I have to do research to make sure that what I'm talking about as far as bricks and mortar details are accurate. And the rest of it is my imagination and how the plot goes. But there are a lot of writers out there who just fudge it because they don't want to bother to do the right research. But I've always wanted to entertain and inform with my books. And the way that I inform is to go out and do research and let people discover something maybe they didn't know before they opened one of my novels.
Right. In some of your previous books, obviously you had to have been meeting with FBI agents or directors and getting more... what's the word I'm looking for? Statistical,
you get
real information.
And you get a level of authenticity, a veneer of authenticity from them that you can then put into your novel. But even as a fiction writer, you have to be careful about that. All of us have read flip books, and I call flip books a kind of done a lot of research but doesn't want to take the time to integrate it into the book. So they just plop it into one space. And everybody who's read a book like this knows where it is because you read the story and it's going well, then you run into the research has been plopped over like five pages. And you flip till you get past that, and you pick the story up again. It takes a lot more work to integrate your research into a novel, but it's well worth it because the last thing you want to do as a novelist is to interrupt the story flow with anything like that. If you interrupt the story flow with research that's been badly integrated, then you haven't done your job.
Well, that's why it looks like it was a whole bunch more fun to write The Christmas Train because you didn't have to go out and meet with people and do any kind of investigative work per se other than work on your life experiences and imagination.
Yeah, it was really great. I mean, riding the trains, I absorbed a lot of atmosphere, and I just, any time that I would ride, I would sit and talk to people, until midnight, train people who've worked these trains for years, and just listen to stories, and it was a lot of fun, but at the same time, I was able to let my imagination just run wild in this and come up with all these zany sorts of events and put these people into dire straits and inject holiday magic along the way. It was just a lot of fun, and I think one reason the new book I'm working on is going so well is that The Christmas Train was sort of a catharsis for me. I was able to step back and just approach a story from a different way, and it was just a lot of fun.
Seems like The Christmas Train would make an excellent movie.
Absolutely.
When you write a book or when you wrote The Christmas Train, was that thought in the back of your mind?
Well, if you'd asked me that 7 years ago, it might have been, but I've been through so much in Hollywood that... I don't even think about that anymore.
Oh, it doesn't sound good here.
So what do you talk to us.
Yeah, tell us what
do you mean? Because maybe we could learn something here. Have any of your other books been made into movies?
Well, Absolute Power was a big blockbuster with Clint Eastwood and Gene Hackman. That did very well. They changed the movie substantially. There was very little of the book that was left in the movie. I've sold other projects to Hollywood, both for film and television, and plus a television series that Paramount's working on now. But you have to understand that Hollywood is not a writer's town. It's a director's town. And most people in Hollywood don't make movies. They develop material until it's determined they're not going to make it into a movie, and they move on to something else. So I've been through the gamut of, gee, yeah, we're going to make it, we love it, it's great, and then you get the phone call that says, we're not going to do it. But thank you very much anyway. So at this point, I just write the books. If people adapt them into movies or television or whatever, then that's fine. But for a writer to count on that, it's just a fool's game. Because 9 times out of 10, it's not going to happen. I mean, Hollywood only makes 450 movies a year that are released in the United States. Mm-hmm. They probably buy 100,000 properties a year.
Oh.
Obviously, you can see those numbers.
1 out of 20.
Yeah, more like 1 out of 1,000,000, because that 100,000 accumulates.
Oh, I see.
And if they didn't buy another piece of property for the next 1,000 years, they have enough already in stock to make movies out of.
I didn't know that.
Who was an author that we talked about before that sold a bunch of Clive Cussler?
Right. Yeah.
He sold, I don't remember, 12 different or 14 different novels. None of them have been made.
Yeah.
Right.
But
yeah.
Didn't he get like $4 million a piece?
I don't know. I'm sure he's not complaining about it.
Oh, my gosh.
He probably sent all of his kids through college on the money. So.
And then
some of the writers are known as sort of the option kings.
Uh-huh.
Because they've had all their books optioned and none of them have ever been made. And it won't be made. I mean, some directors or studios buy properties out there just to say, I just got the next David Baldacci book. I'm a major player. And, you know, and the aside is, well, I'm never going to make it, but I bought it. So that's
right.
The mentality.
For those out there who are aspiring writers, David, I've got a couple questions for you. First of all, how do you write a book? Are you a morning writer, night writer? Do you do
notes,
outlines?
Yeah.
What's your style?
I have no set schedule, and I know that you hear the old adage, okay, you get up at 6 and write until noon, and you turn out 2,000 words a day or 5 pages. That's ridiculous. Every writer approaches it differently. I have an office outside the home where I write, but that doesn't mean that I write from 9 to 5. I tend to write in bursts. I think about what I'm going to write a lot before I ever put anything down. Until I have it right in my head, I don't tend to write. And then I'll write in bursts of 10 pages, 20 pages, 3 pages, whatever is good. I always, people say, I do my 5 pages every day. And I look at them and I say, yeah, but what if the 6th page was going to be, like, awesome? Are you just going to stop at page 5? Or
right.
If you only had really 2 good pages in you, are you just going to sit in front of your computer and write 3 pages of trash?
Yeah.
So every day is different for me. And some, there might be weeks that go by that I don't write anything, but I'm always, always thinking about the story. And yes, I do outlines. I take lots of notes, and the story evolves, and I change my mind a million times, and some characters fall away, and others come to a greater degree of importance in the story. But that's why every day is different. I could never, have a schedule where, okay, at 6 o'clock, I put on my smoking jacket, my pipe, I get my little furry dog, and I record, 5,000 words to my secretary. I mean,
right.
It's just not the life of a writer.
So do you do record versus type yourself?
Oh, no. I'm kidding.
Okay, oh, okay. I didn't know.
I think Daniel Steele does that. I don't. I compose on computer for the most part, and mm-hmm. I always take my laptop with me when I'm traveling. I just got back yesterday from Pittsburgh. We took the first leg of the Capital Limited, the first leg of the Christmas train up to Pittsburgh. The BBC flew in from London. We got on the train and they recorded the whole thing to see, my thoughts and feelings. And also they talked to people on the train to get, the atmosphere of what it's like to take this trip.
Now, do you ever get in the zone when you're working on these books? And I know I find myself sometimes I get into a heavy project and all of a sudden I look at the clock, it's 4 a.m.
All the time. I mean, ask my poor wife. I tend to zone out at the most inopportune times, like, Thanksgiving dinner, parties and things like that, when I'm supposed to be focused on something else. My wife, she always tells our neighbors when we first moved to where we live now, she said, she went around and said, listen, my husband wanders around a lot looking lost. but don't worry, he always comes back home and he's not dangerous. But if he doesn't come back home and you find him like in your yard or something, just call me and I'll come and get him.
Wow.
So that's, that's kind of my life.
David, when you first started writing your books, did you submit drafts to any of your peers or were you in any writing groups?
I wasn't. I was very private about it. Only my wife and my parents and my brother and sister knew that I was writing, because for me it was a very private thing, and I had no ambitions to be a best-selling thriller writer. That's not the sort of stuff I wrote way back when. It was just a hobby of mine. I like writing the stories and sending them out to be published. I didn't belong to any writing groups. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It would might have been better if I had, but it was just a very private thing that I didn't want to share with anybody. So after my first novel sold, it was quite frantic running around telling our close friends about it all and telling my father-in-law that I had this secret life where I was a writer and things like that. But as far as getting published, I would produce material and I would send it out to people, short stories, magazines to publish short stories. With my first novel, I got names of agents from various sources, and including the writer's market, and also from friends of mine in Hollywood mm-hmm. who knew my screenplays. And I set up the whole manuscript, which is probably the wrong thing to do. Now they say send a query letter and some sample chapters. But I sent up, you know, a short letter that basically said, this is what the book is about, and if you read the first page, you won't stop until you read the last page, sincerely, me. And I thought, if I couldn't be confident in the material, how could they be?
Right.
How many rejections did it take before you got accepted?
Well, I've gotten rejected a lot over the years with my short stories and my screenplays. But you have to understand, I was writing, you know, for over 15 years before I wrote and finished Absolute Power. So when I wrote that book, I had been writing a long time, and I think I knew what I was doing at that point. So when I sent Absolute Power up to 8 agents in New York, all 8 of them called and wanted to represent me.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Wow, that is. Dave, we've got time for just one or two more quick questions mm-hmm. here. If you had one piece of advice to give an aspiring writer, what would it be?
I would say the first thing you have to do is ask yourself why you want to write. The right answer is, I love it, and I don't care if I ever sell anything. I just have a passion for creating words and stories. And two, don't expect it to come soon. It's not the sort of field where you have immediate success. And if you're in it for the right reasons, you'll last long enough to actually be successful at some level. Never let a rejection dissuade you from writing. It's the most subjective business in the world, and your story might have been rejected because the person who was reviewing it had a bad day, and that's all. The only time you really lose when you get a rejection is if it makes you stop writing. Otherwise, treat it as a badge of honor and move on.
That's some good advice there. Now, just because it's the holidays and all, I just want to ask you this question. What was your favorite, or what is your favorite holiday moment from your past?
Probably when I was in the 7th grade and I had the lead in the school play. It was my job to explain why there was a God. Which for a 7th grader is a little bit intimidating.
Wow, yes.
But my father took the week off. My father worked very hard at his job and to support all of us. And he took a week off, which he'd never done before. And he would pick me up after the play practice each night, and we would go with the family, and we'd go out to dinner. And we were a family. We didn't go out to dinner. It was just not something economically we could do. But I don't know. He probably blew his whole, you know, weekly paycheck. We went out. We had dinner. We're just together as a family for that whole week when I was in 7th grade. And I'm in the car and seeing him after play practice and seeing my dad, which it just didn't happen, sitting in the car waiting to pick me up. And that memory is still so vivid for me. It's one of the best Christmases I ever had.
That's awesome.
David, thank you very much for joining us on the book show. The Christmas Train is a marvelous book.
Now, it's available all bookstores.
Yes, it's everywhere.
Amazon, through the web, everywhere.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Great.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, and I hope you come back. I hope you come back again, David.
Thank you.
All right. Take care and good luck.
Thanks.
That's David Baldacci, author of The Christmas Train. You can buy that book in bookstores everywhere. This is The Book Show, Cutting Edge Talk about Cutting Edge Books on WLEE Hot Talk 990. We'll be right back.
A filler with romance and disease. Diary entry 9th of May 62. We've had some ugly babies, but now we're quite. Diary entry 62.
Hot Talk 990.
Herman Melville's Moby Dick, brought to you by Geico Auto Insurance.
I am inside the whale. It is dark, it is cold, arg, and yet I am in good spirits. Because with Geico, I get immediate claim service. Arg.
We get the ball rolling on your claim the moment you call, and you could save 15% on car insurance. Call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO.
Hey, why wait till after Thanksgiving to gobble up great deals when you can shop now and save big at Radio Shack? Enjoy incredible movie viewing at home with a complete RCA home theater surround sound system on sale now, just $297. Save $50. And don't miss out on Radio Shack's new PlayStation 2 value pack, complete with PS2 game console, 2 controllers, 2 games, and more. Everything you need for one low price. So why wait? Shop now and save big for the holidays at Radio Shack. You've got questions, we've got answers.
Do you love to read? If so, we have the magazine for you. Pages Magazine is filled with interviews with your favorite authors, news about publishing, and information on all the latest book releases. Find out what today's top authors are saying and learn which new books are coming to a bookstore near you soon. Pages is your best source for all the latest on books. We'll help you decide what you want to read next. Visit www.ireadpages.com to subscribe to Pages today. You'll get one full year, 6 big issues, delivered right to your door for the incredible low price of $10. As a book show listener, you'll be eligible for our lowest rate ever, only $10 for one full year of Pages magazine. Just visit www.ireadpages.com and click subscribe. Enter The Book Show in the promotion code, and you'll be a Pages subscriber. You can also visit our website to receive a free sample issue with no obligation. See for yourself why Pages is the magazine for people who love books.
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to eNovel.com. At eNovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. eNovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, eNovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.eNovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.
Richmond's station for talk.
Hot Talk 990.
Welcome to the book show heard coast to coast. I'm Alex Papagen.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books. We just got finished talking to David Baldacci, author of The Christmas Train. And now we're going to be talking with Beth Fahner, or Fahner. She's going to tell me which one it is in just a moment. I'm sure she's managing editor of Pages Magazine, the magazine for people who love books. Beth, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Hi, Beth.
Pronounce your last name for me.
Fahner.
Fahner, okay. Mm-hmm. Beth Fahner. Well, welcome to the book show.
Thank you.
And Beth, you've got some titles that you wanted to talk about on the book show, so why don't we get to the first one? We got about a minute and a half per book.
Okay, great.
All right, the first one is The Little Friend by Donna Tartt.
Right, this is definitely one of my favorites of the year. The Little Friend is Donna Tartt's long-awaited second novel. Tartt made her stunning debut 10 years ago with The Secret History, which was an international bestseller that really developed a kind of cult following.
Mm-hmm.
Like The Secret History, The Little Friend is a dark story set in the aftermath of a murder. It takes place in the early 70s in a small Mississippi town. The story's main character, Harriet, was only a baby when her 9-year-old brother, Robin, was found hanging from a tree in their backyard. The crime was never solved, and the family never completely recovered from the tragedy. With an absent father and a mother defeated by her grief, Harriet and her sister grow up largely unsupervised. And in the summer of her 12th year, Harriet, who is precocious and fiercely determined, decides to find Robin's killer and exact her revenge. Her only confidant in this dangerous mission is her 11-year-old friend, Healy. The Little Friend is beautifully written and full of suspense, and I think it was definitely worth the 10-year wait.
Gotcha. Now, is this fiction?
Yes.
It is
mm-hmm.
fiction. Gosh.
Right.
Interesting. And you say it's Miss Tartt's second book?
Right, her second novel.
Her second novel.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And is her book being widely distributed in Barnes and Nobles and Borders, or
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it sounds good. Let's go to the second book, Constance.
Okay.
Constance by Catherine Cantrell.
Right. Catherine Cantrell was one of our promising debut authors from earlier this year.
Right.
And Cantrell's elegantly written first novel tells the story of Constance, a beautiful yet mysterious poet whose writing means everything to her, and her friendship with Morgan, an editor at a prestigious New York publishing house. Disillusioned by the harsh realities of the publishing business, Morgan has all but lost her belief in literature until she meets this dedicated writer who restores her faith in pure artistic talent. This debut novel features original poetry throughout and includes several references to literary greats such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, Emily Dickinson, and Sylvia Plath.
Oh.
I think Catherine Cantrell is a writer to keep an eye on.
Now, the original poetry,
mm-hmm.
by that you mean Catherine Cantrell wrote the poetry, too.
Right, right.
I see.
Who, this character, Constance, it's, you know, supposedly her poetry, right?
I see.
Right.
Well, that's really interesting because poetry books, just books only on poetry, don't tend to do that well. But here's a way for somebody to get some poetry into a regular fictional novel.
Right, that's exactly what she did, because Cantrell started out as a poet, and that's really how she got started and, you know, wanted to move into fiction, get a book published, and this was a great way to incorporate
right.
poetry.
And
so.
sell a lot of books. I mean,
right.
why not? That's
right.
a good idea, good idea.
Exactly.
All right, let's go to our third book, which is Raising Blaze by Deborah Ginsberg.
Right. We move into nonfiction with this book. Raising Blaze is Deborah Ginsberg's touching memoir of raising a child with special needs. This book chronicles the time from when her son is born up through his junior high years. Blaise defied an easy diagnosis ever since his birth, and this memoir reveals the struggles that Ginsburg and her son went through with doctors, teachers, and special education administrators.
Mm.
This is Ginsburg's second memoir. Her first was Waiting, The True Confessions of a Waitress, which was about her 20 years spent waiting tables to support her writing career. In both of her memoirs, Ginsburg, who is a single parent, writes about her family, including her parents, her sisters, and her brother. So Raising Blaise is really a continuation of that first story.
I see. Now, by special needs, are we talking about mentally disadvantaged, or is it physical, muscular dystrophy, autism?
What they first, when Blaise first went to school, they labeled him speech and learning disabled.
I see.
But he's really had a whole range of diagnoses, and, you know, nothing was ever really determined. So, you know, he's presently going to high school and doing well, but...
It's a struggle.
Yes, it's a struggle.
It's a struggle.
So it's a really fascinating memoir, and I think it will appeal to a broad audience, both people with children and without.
Right. All right, why don't we move to our fourth book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, by Sarah Vowell.
Okay, this is a hilarious collection of essays about life in America from Sarah Vowell, best known as a contributing editor and storyteller on public radio's This American Life, and she's also the author of Take the Cannoli. From spending Thanksgiving with her family in her New York City apartment to exploring an underground lunchroom in New Mexico's Carlsbad Caverns National Park to her riffs on popular culture, this is insightful social commentary at its best. It's a very smart and witty book.
Hmm.
So.
Social commentary. So, like, what kind of social commentary are we talking about on families, on politics, on...
Is this for young, old?
Everybody? Yeah, I think all ages could enjoy it. So,
how did you hear about this author? Just Simon & Schuster came out with a book? And
I had read her previous book, Take the Cannoli, so I was... you know, I knew her from that, so, yeah.
Interesting.
It's pretty fun.
The fifth book is Gift Book, Teddy's World, by Joost Elfers and Mira DeVries.
Right. Yeah, Teddy's World, this month actually marks the 100th anniversary of the teddy bear. And so in honor of the centennial, Joost Elfers and Mira DeVries, who owns the largest collection of teddy bear photographs in the world, created Teddy's World, a visually stunning tribute to these furry friends. This book is beautifully designed and features 200 full-color photo montages of the teddy bear's world. Just makes a really nice gift book, I think, that can be enjoyed by all ages.
Right. I didn't know that. 100-year anniversary of the teddy bear.
Is this November, right?
Wow.
This November.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you learn something new every day.
Right.
I didn't know that, I mean, bears have been around for centuries, but
right.
I guess...
That teddy bear.
I guess 100 years ago, somebody actually sewed one up.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, real quick, just, Beth, a word about yourself. You're managing editor of Pages
Magazine.
And so what do you do with Pages? Do you edit all articles that come in, or do you write original articles yourself?
I do both. I write original articles. I assign articles to freelancers, edit things that come in. Just kind of everything.
Is there anything that you just love, like you would do it even if nobody paid you to do it? Any task at Pages?
Probably writing. That's my favorite part of the job.
And would you love to write your own novel someday?
Yes, I would.
You do? Well, I don't blame you. Beth, thank you so much for coming
you.
On the show.
My
We're
going
to have these books on the Book Show website, okay?
Oh, great.
Okay. Thanks, and please
thank
come
you.
Back. We're looking
I
forward
will.
To having you again.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you, Beth.
Okay.
That was Beth Fanner, Managing Editor, Pages Magazine. Enjoyed that very much.
Yes.
They're looking out for books that they really like at Pages Magazine. These are some of the most knowledgeable, informative people in the publishing business at Pages Magazine.
And you can tell by their magazine. And I highly recommend it to anybody. Just go to a bookstore and take a look at it, and I guarantee you'll be buying it.
That's right.
And subscribing.
Go to iReadPages.com.
Right. Or to your local bookstore.
Right, or your local bookstore. Okay, we're going to be doing the top 10 books in America according to Amazon.com.
And tell us which ones are the new ones, too. I'm always curious on that.
All right, the new ones. Well, you know what? They don't rank it like USA Today does.
Oh, really?
So I'm not sure. We're going to start at number 10, the 10th ranked book in America, Harry Potter, paperback box set books 1 through 4 by J.K. Rowling, number 9 in the country, according to Amazon.com. The Sea Hunters 2 by Clive Cussler.
Excellent.
One of your favorite authors.
Yes, yes.
Number 8 in the country, and I've browsed this book myself. Who Says Elephants Can't Dance? Inside IBM's Historic Turnaround by Louis V. Gerstner Jr. And that guy really did turn around IBM, one of the most important companies in America.
He took that stock, was down, what, about $50 a share when he came in?
Right, it was. And actually, Lou Gerstner, of course, is no longer CEO of
He's
IBM.
He's still chairman, though, isn't he? Or no?
He may be. He just accepted a CEO position at a huge private equity firm called the Carlyle Group. I just read it in the newspaper. Number 7 in the country, Hornet Flight by Ken Follett. Number 6 in the country, and this has been on all the top 10 lists for months and months and months, The Lovely Bones by Alice Siebold. It's gotten great reviews. It really has.
Oh, maybe we have to get her on here.
Yeah, number 5 in the country, I Don't Know How She Does It by Allison Pearson. Number 4 in the country, and I'm trying to get these two authors on the book show, The Sopranos Family Cookbook.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I mean, it's on a lot of the top 10 lists. Some great recipes, told with attitude, The Sopranos attitude. I have to admit, though, I'm guilty. I haven't seen The Sopranos yet, so I think
that's because you don't have HBO, I bet.
I don't have HBO.
There you go.
All right, number 3 in the country, according to Amazon.com, Four Blind Mice by James Patterson. Number 2 in the country, Bob Woodward of The Washington Post, his new book, Bush at War. And finally, the number 1 book in America this past week, according to Amazon.com, Prey by Michael Crichton.
Now, that just jumped up there. Oh, then again, we're talking about a different list here.
Yeah,
so
it's a
I'm
different
sure.
list, and everybody's got their own formula.
So this is the Amazon list.
This is the Amazon list.
So this goes based on Amazon sales or national sales overall?
I think this is just Amazon's on their website, updated hourly.
Okay.
Updated hourly.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Any contests in Contest Corner?
First, I'd like to say that you have to remember we have a website, www.thebookshow.com. All the information you ever want about this whole show is there. You can listen to previous shows, complete front to back. You can hear your favorite author. But most importantly, this is the Contest Corner, so you can get all the contest information. We have a sponsor, Writer's Digest. There's a link there to their contest, and they have contests going on every day about any number of different topics. We have our own contest for those people who are writing challenged. You don't need to be a writer. You can simply enter your information, get on our mailing list, and we're giving away free MP3 players right now. And that product does change every now and then, but for the next few months, we've got a number of MP3 players. Now, we also list other contests you'll find in the web. The first one is Amazing Kids Fall Holiday Essay, but this is one you have to jump on real quick. Again, the information will be on our website, thebookshow.com, under contests, but you have until Thanksgiving Day to get this one in. This is for kids, a simple one-page essay, and it's time, what's the word for it? This is a time when people get together with their families and friends to show their appreciation and give thanks for all they have to be grateful for. So tell us what you're grateful for, and you can win. It's just a one-page essay, and the information will be on our website, and it's an email, so you don't have to mail it, just email it in. The next one is the Mona Schreiber Prize for Humorous Fiction and Nonfiction, up to 750 words. Should be typed. All entries must be postmarked by December 1st for a December 24th announcement. And it's a $500, $250, and $100 prize, and that one costs $5 to enter. And finally, which is a large one, is Scholastic. And if anyone who's ever bought a children's book knows of the company Scholastic, well, they're running a bunch of contests, 300 different writing awards. So go to our website to gather all the information about that. And this is for, let's see, grades 7 through 12.
About 30 seconds.
Well, that's all I have on contest.
Great.
But remember, you got to go to our website, thebookshow.com.
Thebookshow.com. Enjoy the show a lot. David Baldacci, what a nice guy.
Yes. Really next time we have to have him live, though, especially being here.
We're going to do it live. Next week, we have another Virginia-based author, William Hoffman, author of Wild Thorn. Actually, he was a professor of a fellow that we know here in Richmond, Virginia, named Stephen Hawley Martin, who's also an author. Yeah,
fantastic.
Professor of his. So William Hoffman, Wild Thorn. Thanks for joining us on The Book Show. We'll see you next week. Take care,
folks.
Thank you.